Donald Trump's personal interests and the interests of his 2020 re-election campaign. And the Ukrainian president knew about both in advance, in part because of efforts by Ambassadors Sondland and Volker to make him aware of President Trump's demands. The next day, July 26th, in Kyiv, Holmes served as a note-taker during a meeting between Acting Ambassador Bill Taylor, Volker, and Sondland with President Zelensky and other senior Ukrainian officials. Zelensky said that on the previous day's call, President Trump had, quote, three times raised some very sensitive issues that he would have to follow up on those issues when they met in person. Although he did not realize it at the time, Holmes came to understand that the sensitive issues were the investigations that President Trump demanded on the July 25th call. Following the meeting with Zelensky, Holmes accompanied Sondland to a separate meeting with the Ukrainian president's top advisors, Andrei Yermak. But Holmes was not allowed into the meeting and waited for 30 minutes while Sondland and the Ukrainian met alone without any note takers to record what they said. After the meeting, Sondland, Holmes, and two other State Department staff went to lunch at a nearby restaurant and sat on an outdoor terrace. At some point during the meal, Sondland pulled out his cell phone, placed a call to the White House, and asked to be connected to the president. When Trump came on the line, Holmes could hear the president's voice clearly. Holmes recalled that, quote, the president's voice was very loud and recognizable, and Ambassador Sondland held the phone away from his ear for a period of time, presumably because of the loud volume. Sondland said he was calling from Kyiv. He told the president that President Zelensky loves your ass. Holmes then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation? Ambassador Sondland replied, he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him. After the call ended, Holmes took the opportunity to ask Sondland for his candid impression of the president's views on Ukraine. It was at this point that Sondland revealed that President Trump doesn't give a expletive about Ukraine. The president only cares about big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing. A month later, National Security Advisor Bolton traveled to Kyiv. Between meetings with Ukrainian government officials, Holmes heard Bolton express to Ambassador Bill Taylor his frustration about Mr. Giuliani's influence with the president. Bolton made clear, however, there was nothing he could do about it. Bolton further stated that the hold on security assistance would not be lifted prior to the upcoming meeting between President Trump and Zelensky in Warsaw, where it would hang on whether Zelensky was able to favorably impress President Trump. Trump canceled his trip to Warsaw, but Sondland, Volker, and others continued to press for a public announcement of the opening of investigations by Zelensky. On September 8, Taylor told Holmes that, quote, now they're insisting Zelensky commit to the investigation in an interview with CNN. Holmes was surprised the requirement was so specific and concrete, since it amounted to nothing less than a, quote, demand that President Zelensky personally commit to a specific investigation of President Trump's political rival on a cable news channel, unquote. On September 9, this committee, along with the Foreign Affairs and Oversight Committees, launched our investigation of this corrupt scheme. President Trump released the hold on aid 2 days later. As CNN's Fareed Zakaria has revealed, the Ukrainians canceled the CNN interview shortly thereafter. 2 weeks later, on September 25th, the transcript of the July 25th call was released by the White House, and the details of the president's scheme started coming into view. In the coming days, Congress will determine what response is appropriate. If the president abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe a vulnerable ally into conducting investigations to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, a White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, it will be for us to decide whether those acts are compatible with the office of the presidency. I now recognize Ranking Member Nunes for any remarks he would like to make.
Thank you. Throughout these bizarre hearings, The Democrats have struggled to make the case that President Trump committed some impeachable offense on his phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. The offense itself changes depending on the day, ranging from quid pro quo to extortion to bribery to obstruction of justice, then back to quid pro quo. It's clear why the Democrats have been forced onto this carousel of accusations. President Trump had good reason to be wary of Ukrainian election meddling against his campaign and of widespread corruption in that country. President Zelensky, who didn't even know aid to Ukraine had been paused at the time of the call, has repeatedly said there was nothing wrong with the conversation. The aid was resumed without the Ukrainians taking the actions they were supposedly being coerced into doing. Aid to Ukraine under President Trump has been much more robust than it was under President Obama, thanks to the provision of Javelin anti-tank weapons. As numerous witnesses have testified, temporary holds on foreign aid occur fairly frequently for many different reasons. So how do we have an impeachable offense here when there's no actual misdeed and no one even claiming to be a victim? The Democrats have tried to solve this dilemma with a simple slogan. He got caught. President Trump, we are to believe, was just about to do something wrong, and getting caught was the only reason he backed down from whatever nefarious thought crime the Democrats are accusing him of almost committing. I once again urge Americans to continue to consider the credibility of the Democrats on this committee who are now hurling these charges. For the last 3 years, it's not President Trump who got caught. It's the Democrats who got caught. They got caught falsely claiming they had more than circumstantial evidence that Trump colluded with Russians to hack the 2016 election. They got caught orchestrating this entire farce with the whistleblower and lying about their secret meetings with him. They got caught defending the false allegations of the Steele dossier, which was paid for by them. They got caught breaking their promise that impeachment would only go forward with bipartisan support because of how damaging it is to the American people. They got caught running a sham impeachment process featuring secret depositions, hidden transcripts, and an unending flood of Democrat leaks to the media. They got caught trying to obtain nude photos of President Trump from Russian pranksters, pretending to be Ukrainians. And they got caught covering up for Alexander Chalupa, a Democratic National Committee operative who colluded with Ukrainian officials to smear the Trump campaign by improperly redacting her name from deposition transcripts and refusing to let Americans hear her testimony as a witness in these proceedings. That is the Democrats' pitiful legacy in recent years. They got caught. Meanwhile, their supposed star witness testified that he was guessing that President Trump was tying Ukrainian aid to investigations despite no one telling him that was true, and the president himself explicitly telling him the opposite, that he wanted nothing from Ukraine. Ladies and gentlemen, unless the Democrats once again scramble their kangaroo court rules, today's hearing marks the merciful end of this spectacle in the impeachment committee, formerly known as the Intelligence Committee. Whether the Democrats reap the political benefit they want from this impeachment remains to be seen, but the damage they have done to this country will be long-lasting. With this wrenching attempt to overthrow the president, they have pitted Americans against one another and poisoned the mind of fanatics who actually believe the entire galaxy of bizarre accusations they have leveled against the president since the day the American people elected him. I sincerely hope the Democrats end this affair as quickly as possible so our nation can begin to heal the many wounds it has inflicted on us. The people's faith in government and their belief that their vote counts for something has been shaken. From the Russia hoax to this shoddy Ukrainian sequel, the Democrats got caught. Let's hope they finally learn a lesson, give their conspiracy theories a rest, and focus on governing for a change. In addition, Mr. Chairman, pursuant to House Rule 11, Clause 2J1, the Republican members transmit our request to convene a minority day of hearings. To date, you have blocked key witnesses that we have requested from testifying in this partisan impeachment inquiry. This rule was not displaced by HRS 660, and therefore, under House Rule 11, Clause 1A, it applies to the Democrats' impeachment inquiry. We look forward to the chair promptly scheduling an agreed-upon time for the minority day of hearings so that we can hear from key witnesses that you have continually blocked from testifying. I'd also like to take a quick moment on an assertion Ms. Hill made in the statement that she submitted to this committee, in which she claimed that some committee members deny that Russia meddled in the 2016 election. As I noted in my opening statement on Wednesday, that in March 2018, Intelligence Committee Republicans published the results of a year-long investigation into Russian meddling. The 240-page report analyzed 2016 Russian meddling campaign, the U.S. government reaction to it, Russian campaigns in other countries, and provided specific recommendations to improve American election security. I'm going to ask my staff to hand these reports to our two witnesses today just so they can have a recollection of their memory. As America may or may not know, Democrats refused to sign on to the Republican report. Instead, they decided to adopt minority views filled with collusion conspiracy theories. Needless to say, it is entirely possible for two separate nations to engage in election meddling at the same time, and Republicans believe we should take meddling seriously by all foreign countries, regardless of which campaign is the target. I'd like to submit for the record a copy of our report titled Report on Russian Active Measures. I yield back.
Today we are joined by Dr. Fiona Hill and David Holmes. Dr. Fiona Hill is a former Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Europe and Russia on the National Security Council. Before returning to government, she was a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where she directed the Center on the United States and Europe. She previously worked at the National Intelligence Council, the Eurasia Foundation, and the John F. Kennedy School of Government. David Holmes is the political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, where he serves as the senior policy and political advisor to Ambassador Taylor, who testified earlier in these hearings. He is a career Foreign Service officer. He has previously served in Moscow, New Delhi, Kabul, Bogota, and Pristina. He has also served on the staff of the National Security Council as his special assistant, to the United States Secretary of State. Two final points before our witnesses are sworn. First, witness depositions as part of this inquiry were unclassified in nature, and all open hearings will also be held at the unclassified level. Any information that may touch on classified information will be addressed separately. Second, Congress will not tolerate any reprisal, threat of reprisal, or attempt to retaliate against any U.S. government official for testifying before Congress, including you or any of your colleagues. If you would please rise. Raise your right hand. I will begin by swearing you in. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Let the record show that the witnesses answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and you may be seated. The microphones are sensitive, so you'll need to speak directly into them. Without objection, your written statements will be made part of the record. With that, Mr. Holmes, you are now recognized for your opening statement, and when you conclude, Dr. Hill, you'll be immediately recognized thereafter for your opening statement.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Nunez, and members of the committee. My name is David Holmes, and I'm a career Foreign Service officer with the Department of State. Since August 2017, I've been the political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, Ukraine. While it is an honor to appear before you today, I want to make clear that I did not seek this opportunity to testify today. Since you determined that I may have something of value to these proceedings and issued a subpoena, it is my obligation to appear and to tell you what I know. Indeed, as Secretary Pompeo has stated, I hope everyone who testifies will do so truthfully and accurately. When they do, the oversight role will have been performed, and I think America will come to see what took place here. That is my only goal, to testify truthfully and accurately to enable you to perform that role. And to that end, I put together this statement to lay out as best I can my recollection of events that may be relevant to this matter. By way of background, I have spent my entire professional career as a Foreign Service officer. Like many of the dedicated public servants who have testified in these proceedings, my entire career has been in the service of my country. I'm a graduate of Pomona College in Claremont, California, and received degrees in international affairs from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland and from Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. I joined the Foreign Service in 2002 through an apolitical, merit-based process under the George W. Bush administration. And I have proudly served administrations of both parties and worked for their appointees, both political and career. Prior to my current post in Kyiv, Ukraine, I served in the political and economic sections at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, Russia. In Washington, I served on the National Security Council staff as director for Afghanistan and as a special assistant to the Undersecretary of State. My prior overseas assignments include New Delhi, India, Kabul, Afghanistan, Bogota, Colombia, and Pristina, Kosovo. As the political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, I lead the political section, covering Ukraine's internal politics, foreign relations, and security policies. And I serve as the senior policy and political ambassador to the advisor to the ambassador. The job of an embassy political counselor is to gather information about the host country's political landscape, to report back to Washington, to represent U.S. policies to foreign contacts, and to advise the ambassador on policy development and implementation. In this role, I'm a senior member of the embassy's country team and continually involved in addressing issues as they arise. I'm also often called upon to take notes in meetings involving the ambassador or visiting senior U.S. officials with Ukrainian counterparts. For this reason, I've been present in many of the meetings with President Zelensky and his administration, some of which may be germane to this inquiry. While I'm a political counselor at the embassy, it is important to note that I'm not a political appointee or engaged in U.S. politics in any way. It is not my job to cover or advise on U.S. politics. On the contrary, I'm an apolitical foreign policy professional, and my job is to focus on the politics of the country in which I serve so that we can better understand the local landscape and better advance U.S. national interests there. In fact, during the period that we'll cover today, my colleagues and I followed direct guidance from Ambassador Yovanovitch and Ambassador Taylor to focus on doing our jobs as foreign policy professionals and to stay clear of Washington politics. I arrived in Kyiv to take up my assignment as political counselor in August 2017, a year after Ambassador Yovanovitch received her appointment. From August 2017 until her removal from post in May 2019, I was Ambassador Yovanovitch's chief policy advisor and developed a deep respect for her dedication, determination, decency, and professionalism. During this time, we worked together closely, speaking multiple times per day, and I accompanied Ambassador Yovanovitch to many of her meetings with senior Ukrainian counterparts. Our work in Ukraine focused on three policy priorities: peace and security, economic growth and reform, and anti-corruption and rule of law. These policies match the three consistent priorities of the Ukrainian people since 2014, as measured in public opinion polling, namely an end to the conflict with Russia that restores national unity and territorial integrity, responsible economic policies that deliver European standards of growth and opportunity, and effective and impartial rule of law institutions that deliver justice in cases of high-level official corruption. Our efforts on this third policy priority merit special mention because it was during Ambassador Yovanovitch's tenure that we achieved the hard-fought passage of a law establishing an independent court to try corruption cases. These efforts strained Ambassador Yovanovitch's relationship with former President Poroshenko and some of his allies, including Prosecutor General Yuri Lutsenko, who resisted fully empowering truly independent anti-corruption institutions that would help ensure that no Ukrainians, however powerful, were above the law. Despite this resistance, the ambassador and the embassy kept pushing anti-corruption and other priorities of our policy towards Ukraine. Beginning in March 2019, the situation at the embassy and in Ukraine changed dramatically. Specifically, the three priorities of security, economy, and justice, and our support for Ukrainian democratic resistance to Russian aggression, became overshadowed by a political agenda promoted by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and a cadre of officials operating with a direct channel to the White House. That change began with the emergence of press reports critical of Ambassador Yovanovitch and machinations by then-Prosecutor General Lutsenko and others to discredit her. In mid-March 2019, an embassy colleague learned from a Ukrainian contact that Mr. Lutsenko had complained that Ambassador Yovanovitch had, quote, destroyed him with her refusal to support him until he followed through with his reform commitments and ceased using his position for personal gain. In retaliation, Mr. Lutsenko made a series of unsupported allegations against Ambassador Yovanovitch, mostly suggesting that Ambassador Yovanovitch improperly used the embassy to advance the political interests of the Democratic Party. Among Mr. Lutsenko's allegations were that the embassy had ordered the investigation of a former Ukrainian official solely because that former official was allegedly the main Ukrainian contact of the Republican Party and of President Trump personally, and that the embassy had allegedly pressured Lutsenko's predecessor to close a case against a different former Ukrainian official solely because of an alleged connection between that official's company, Burisma, and former Vice President Biden's son. Mr. Lutsenko also claimed that he had never received $4.4 million in U.S. funds intended for his office, and that there was a tape of a Ukrainian official saying that he was trying to help Hillary Clinton win the 2016 election. Finally, Mr. Lutsenko publicly claimed that Ambassador Yovanovitch had given him a do not prosecute list containing the names of her supposed allies, an allegation the State Department called an outright fabrication, and that Mr. Lutsenko later retracted. Mr. Lutsenko said that as a result of these allegations, Ambassador Yovanovitch would face serious problems in the United States. Public opinion polls indicated that Ukrainians generally did not believe Mr. Lutsenko's allegations. And on March 22nd, President Poroshenko issued a statement in support of Ambassador Yovanovitch. Following Mr. Lutsenko's allegations, Mr. Giuliani and others made a number of public statements critical of Ambassador Yovanovitch, questioning her integrity and calling for her removal from office. Mr. Giuliani was also making frequent public statements pushing for Ukraine to investigate interference in the 2016 election and issues related to Burisma and the Bidens. For example, on May 1, 2019, the New York Times reported that Mr. Giuliani had, quote, discussed the Burisma investigation and its intersection with the Bidens, with the ousted Ukrainian prosecutor general and the current prosecutor. On May 9th, the New York Times reported that Mr. Giuliani said he planned to travel to Ukraine to pursue investigations into the 2016 election interference and into the involvement of former Vice President Biden's son in a Ukrainian gas company. Over the next few months, Mr. Giuliani also issued a series of tweets asking, quote, why Biden shouldn't be investigated, attacking, quote, the new president of Ukraine, Zelensky, for being silent on the 2016 election and Biden investigations, and complaining about the New York Times attacking him for, quote, exposing the Biden family history of making millions from Ukrainian criminals. Around this time, the Ukrainian presidential election was approaching, and political newcomer and entertainer Volodymyr Zelensky, who had played a president on television, was surging in the polls, ahead of Mr. Lutsenko's political ally, President Poroshenko. On April 20th, I was present for Ambassador Yovanovitch's third and final meeting with then-candidate Zelensky, ahead of his landslide victory in the runoff election the next day. As in her two prior meetings that I also attended, they had an entirely cordial, pleasant conversation and signaled their mutual desire to work together. However, the negative narratives about Ambassador Yovanovitch had gained currency in certain segments of the United States press. On April 26th, Ambassador Yovanovitch departed for Washington, D.C., where she learned that she would be recalled early. The barrage of allegations directed at Ambassador Yovanovitch, a career ambassador, is unlike anything I have seen in my professional career. Following President-elect Zelensky's victory, our attention in the embassy focused on getting to know the incoming Zelensky administration and on preparations for the inauguration scheduled for May 20th, the same day that Ambassador Yovanovitch departed post permanently. It quickly became clear that the White House was not prepared to show the level of support for the Zelensky administration that we had originally anticipated. In early May, Mr. Giuliani publicly alleged that Mr. Zelensky was, quote, surrounded by enemies of the U.S. president and canceled a visit to Ukraine. Shortly thereafter, we learned that Vice President Pence no longer planned to lead the presidential delegation to the inauguration. The White House then whittled down an initial proposed list for the official presidential delegation to the inauguration from over a dozen individuals to just five. Secretary Perry as its head, Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations Kurt Volker, representing the State Department, National Security Council Director Alex Vindman, representing the White House, Temporary Acting Chargé d'Affaires Joseph Pennington, representing the embassy, and Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland. While Ambassador Sondland's mandate as the accredited ambassador to the European Union did not cover individual member states, let alone non-member countries like Ukraine, he made clear that he had direct and frequent access to President Trump and Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and portrayed himself as the conduit to the President and Mr. Mulvaney for this group. Secretary Perry, Ambassador Sondland, and Ambassador Volker later styled themselves the Three Amigos and made clear they would take the lead on coordinating our policy and engagement with the Zelensky administration. Around the same time, I became aware that Mr. Giuliani, a private lawyer, was taking a direct role in Ukrainian diplomacy. On April 25th, Ivan Bakanov, who was Mr. Zelensky's childhood friend and campaign chair and was ultimately appointed the head of the security services of Ukraine, indicated to me privately that he had been contacted by, quote, someone named Giuliani who said he was an advisor to the vice president. I reported Mr. Bakanov's message to Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent. Over the following months, it became apparent that Mr. Giuliani was having a direct influence on the foreign policy agenda that the Three Amigos were executing on the ground in Ukraine. In fact, at one point during a preliminary meeting of the inaugural delegation, someone wondered aloud why Mr. Giuliani was so active in the media with respect to Ukraine. My recollection is that Ambassador Sondland stated, quote, damn it, Rudy. Every time Rudy gets involved, he goes and F's everything up. The inauguration took place on May 20th, and I took notes in the delegation's meeting with President Zelensky. During the meeting, Secretary Perry passed President Zelensky a list that Perry described as, quote, people he trusts. Secretary Perry told President Zelensky that he could seek advice from the people on this list on issues of energy sector reform, which was the topic of subsequent meetings between Secretary Perry and key Ukrainian energy sector contacts. Embassy personnel were excluded from some of these later meetings by Secretary Perry's staff. On May 23rd, Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland, Secretary Perry, and Senator Ron Johnson, who had also attended the inauguration, though not on the official delegation, returned to the United States and briefed President Trump. On May 29th, President Trump signed a congratulatory letter to President Zelensky, which included an invitation to visit the White House at an unspecified date. It is important to understand that a White House visit was critical to President Zelensky. President Zelensky needed to show U.S. support at the highest levels in order to demonstrate to Russian President Putin that he had U.S. backing, as well as to advance his ambitious anti-corruption reform agenda at home. President Zelensky's team immediately began pressing to set a date for that visit. President Zelensky and senior members of his team made clear that they wanted President Zelensky's first overseas trip to be to Washington to send a strong signal of American support, and requested a call with President Trump as soon as possible. We at the embassy also believed that a meeting was critical to the success of President Zelensky's administration and its reform agenda, and we worked hard to get it arranged. When President Zelensky's team did not receive a confirmed date for a White House visit, they made alternative plans for President Zelensky's first overseas trip to be to Brussels instead, in part to attend an American Independence Day event that Ambassador Sondland hosted on June 4th. Ambassador Sondland hosted a dinner in President Zelensky's honor following the reception, which included President Zelensky, Jared Kushner, Secretary Pompeo's counselor Ulrich Breckbuehl, senior European Union officials, and comedian Jay Leno, among others. Ambassador Bill Taylor arrived in Kyiv as Chargé d'Affaires on June 17th. For the next month, the focus of our activities, along with those of the three amigos, was to coordinate a White House visit. To that end, we were working with Ukrainians to deliver things that we thought President Trump might care about, such as commercial deals that would benefit the United States, which might convince President Trump to agree to a meeting with President Zelensky. The Ukrainian policy community was unanimous in its recommendation in recognizing the importance of securing the meeting and President Trump's support. Ambassador Taylor reported that Secretary Pompeo had told him prior to his arrival in Kyiv, quote, "We need to work on turning the president around on Ukraine." Ambassador Volker told us that the next 5 years could hang on what could be accomplished in the next 3 months. I took that to mean that if we did not earn President Trump's support in the next 3 months, we could lose the opportunity to make progress during President Zelensky's five-year term. Within a week or two, it became apparent that the energy sector reforms, the commercial deals, and the anti-corruption efforts on which we were making progress were not making a dent in terms of persuading the White House to schedule a meeting between the presidents. On June 27th, Ambassador Sondland told Ambassador Taylor in a phone conversation, the gist of which Ambassador Taylor shared with me at the time, that President Zelensky needed to make clear to President Trump that President Zelensky was not standing in the way of, quote, investigations. I understood that this meant the Biden-Burisma investigations that Mr. Giuliani and his associates had been speaking about in the media since March. While Ambassador Taylor did not brief me on every detail of his communications with the three amigos, he did tell me that on a June 28th call with President Zelensky, Ambassador Taylor and the three amigos, it was made clear that some action on Burisma-Biden investigation was a precondition for an Oval Office visit. Also on June 28th, while President Trump was still not moving forward on a meeting with President Zelensky, he met with Russian President Putin at the G20 summit in Osaka, Japan, sending a further signal of lack of support to Ukraine. We became concerned that even if a meeting between Presidents Trump and Zelensky could occur, it would not go well. And I discussed with embassy colleagues whether we should stop seeking a meeting altogether. While the White House visit was critical to the Zelensky administration, a visit that failed to send a clear and strong signal of support likely would be worse for President Zelensky than no visit at all. Congress has appropriated $1.5 billion in security assistance for Ukraine since 2014. This assistance has provided crucial material and moral support to Ukraine in its defensive war with Russia, and has helped Ukraine build its armed forces virtually from scratch into arguably the most capable and battle-hardened land force in Europe. I've had the honor of visiting the main training facility in western Ukraine with members of Congress and members of this very committee, Ms. Stefanik, where we witnessed firsthand U.S. National Guard troops, along with allies, conducting training for Ukrainian soldiers. Since 2014, National Guard units from California, Oklahoma, New York, Tennessee, and Wisconsin have trained shoulder to shoulder with Ukrainian counterparts. Given the history of U.S. security assistance to Ukraine and the bipartisan recognition of its importance, I was shocked when on July 18th, an Office of Management and Budget staff member surprisingly announced the hold on Ukraine security assistance. The announcement came toward the end of a nearly two-hour National Security Council secure video conference call, which I participated in from the embassy conference room. The official said that the order had come from the president and had been conveyed to OMB by Mr. Mulvaney with no further explanation. This began a week or so of efforts by various agencies to identify the rationale for the freeze, to conduct a review of the assistance, and to reaffirm the unanimous view of the Ukraine policy community of its importance. NSC counterparts confirmed to us that there had been no change in our Ukraine policy, but could not determine the cause of the hold or how to lift it. On July 25th, President Trump made a congratulatory phone call to President Zelensky after his party won a commanding majority in Ukraine's parliamentary election. Contrary to standard procedure, the embassy received no readout of that call, and I was unaware of what was discussed until the transcript was released on September 25th. Upon reading the transcript, I was deeply disappointed to see that the president raised none of what I understood to be our interagency agreed upon foreign policy priorities in Ukraine, and instead raised the Biden-Burisma investigation and referred to the theory about CrowdStrike and its supposed connection to Ukraine in the 2016 election. The next day, July 26, 2019, I attended meetings at the Presidential Administration building in Kyiv with Ambassador Taylor, Ambassador Volker, and Ambassador Sondland, and I took notes during those meetings. Our first meeting was with President Zelensky's chief of staff. It was brief, as he had already been summoned by President Zelensky to prepare for a subsequent broader meeting. But he did say that President Trump had expressed interest during the previous day's phone call in President Zelensky's personnel decisions related to the Prosecutor General's office. The delegation then met with President Zelensky and several other senior officials. During the meeting, President Zelensky stated that during the July 25th call, President Trump had, quote, three times raised some very sensitive issues, and that he would have to follow up, he, Zelensky, would have to follow up on those issues when he and President Trump met in person. Not having received a readout of the July 25th call, I did not know at the time what those sensitive issues were. After the meeting with President Zelensky, Ambassador Volker and Ambassador Taylor quickly left the Presidential Administration building for a trip to the front lines. Ambassador Sondland, who was to fly out that afternoon, stayed behind to have a meeting with Andriy Yermak, a top aide to President Zelensky. As I was leaving the meeting with President Zelensky, I was told to join the meeting with Ambassador Sondland and Mr. Yermak to take notes. I had not expected to join that meeting and was a flight of stairs behind Ambassador Sondland as he headed to meet with Mr. Yermak. When I reached Mr. Yermak's office, Ambassador Sondland had already gone into the meeting. I explained to Mr. Yermak's assistant that I was supposed to join the meeting as the embassy's representative and strongly urged her to let me in, but she told me that Ambassador Sondland and Mr. Yermak had insisted that the meeting be one-on-one with no note taker. I then waited in the anteroom until the meeting ended, along with a member of Ambassador Sondland's staff and a member of the U.S. Embassy Kyiv staff. When the meeting ended, the two staffers and I accompanied Ambassador Sondland out of the Presidential Administration building. Ambassador Sondland said that he wanted to go to lunch, and I told Ambassador Sondland that I'd be happy to join him and the two staffers for lunch if he wanted to brief me out on his meeting with Mr. Yermak or discuss other issues. And Ambassador Sondland said that I should join. The four of us went to a nearby restaurant and sat on an outdoor terrace. I sat directly across from Ambassador Sondland, and the two staffers sat off to our sides. At first, the lunch was largely social. Ambassador Sondland selected a bottle of wine that he shared among the four of us, and we discussed topics such as marketing strategies for his hotel business. During the lunch, Ambassador Sondland said that he was going to call President Trump to give him an update. Ambassador Sondland placed a call on his mobile phone, and I heard him announce himself several times along the lines of Gordon Sondland holding for the president. It appeared that he was being transferred through several layers of switchboards and assistants, and I then noticed Ambassador Sondland's demeanor changed and understood that he had been connected to President Trump. While Ambassador Sondland's phone was not on speakerphone, I could hear the president's voice through the earpiece of the phone. The president's voice was loud and recognizable, and Ambassador Sondland held the phone away from his ear for a period of time, presumably because of the loud volume. I heard Ambassador Sondland greet the president and explain he was calling from Kyiv. I heard President Trump then clarify that Ambassador Sondland was in Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do. Even though I did not take notes of these statements, I have a clear recollection that these statements were made. I believe that my colleagues who were sitting at the table also knew that Ambassador Sondland was speaking with the president. The conversation then shifted to Ambassador Sondland's efforts on behalf of the president to assist a rapper who was jailed in Sweden. And I can only hear Ambassador Sondland's side of the conversation. Ambassador Sondland told the president that the rapper was, quote, kind of effed there and should have pled guilty. He recommended that the president, quote, wait until after the sentencing or it will only make it worse. And he added that the president should let him get sentenced, play the racism card, give him a ticker tape when he comes home. Ambassador Sondland further told the president that Sweden, quote, should have released him on your word, but that you can tell the Kardashians you tried. After the call ended, Ambassador Sondland remarked that the president was in a bad mood, as Ambassador Sondland stated it was often the case early in the morning. I then took the opportunity to ask Ambassador Sondland for his candid impression of the president's views on Ukraine. In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not, and Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing. The conversation then moved on to other topics. Upon returning to the embassy, I immediately briefed my direct supervisor, the deputy chief of mission, about Ambassador Sondland's call with President Trump and my subsequent conversation with Ambassador Sondland. I told others at the embassy about the call as well. I also emailed an embassy official in Sweden regarding the issue with the U.S. rapper that was discussed on the call. July 26th was my last day in the office ahead of a long-planned vacation that ended on August 6th. After returning to the embassy, I told Ambassador Taylor about the July 26th call. I also repeatedly referred to the call and the conversation with Ambassador Sondland in meetings and conversations where the issue of the president's interest in Ukraine was potentially relevant. At that time, Ambassador Sondland's statement to the president, statement of the president's lack of interest in Ukraine was of particular focus. We understood that in order to secure a meeting between President Trump and President Zelensky, we would have to work hard to find a way to explain Ukraine's importance to President Trump in terms that he found compelling. Over the ensuing weeks, we continued to try to identify ways to frame the importance of Ukraine in ways that would appeal to the president, to determine how to lift the hold on security assistance, and to move forward on the scheduling of a White House visit by President Zelensky. Ukrainian Independence Day, August 24th, presented another good opportunity to show support for Ukraine. Secretary Pompeo had considered attending, as National Security Advisor Bolton had attended in 2018, and Defense Secretary Mattis had attended in 2017. But in the end, nobody senior to Ambassador Volker attended. Shortly thereafter, on August 27th, Ambassador Bolton visited Ukraine and brought welcome news that President Trump had agreed to meet President Zelensky on September 1st in Warsaw. Ambassador Bolton further indicated that the hold on security assistance would not be lifted prior to the Warsaw meeting, where it would hang on whether President Zelensky was able to, quote, favorably impress President Trump. I took notes in Ambassador Bolton's meetings that day with President Zelensky and his chief of staff. Ambassador Bolton told Zelensky's chief of staff that the meeting between the presidents in Warsaw would be, quote, crucial to cementing their relationship. However, President Trump ultimately pulled out of the Warsaw trip, so the hold remained in place with no clear means to get it lifted. Between the meetings on August 27th, I heard Ambassador Bolton express to Ambassador Taylor and National Security Council Senior Director Tim Morrison his frustration about Mr. Giuliani's influence with the president, making clear there was nothing he could do about it. He recommended that Mr. Lutsenko's replacement as Prosecutor General open a channel with his counterpart, Attorney General Barr, in place of the informal channel between Mr. Yermak and Mr. Giuliani. Ambassador Bolton also expressed frustration about Ambassador Sondland's expansive interpretation of his mandate. After President Trump canceled his visit to Warsaw, we continued to try to appeal to the president in foreign policy and national security terms. To that end, Ambassador Taylor told me that Ambassador Bolton recommended that he, Ambassador Taylor, send a first-person cable to Secretary Pompeo articulating the importance of the security assistance. At Ambassador Taylor's direction, I drafted and transmitted the cable on Ambassador Taylor's behalf on August 29th, which further attempted to explain the importance of Ukraine and the security assistance to U.S. national security. By this point, however, my clear impression was that the security assistance hold was likely intended by the president either as an expression of dissatisfaction with the Ukrainians, who had not yet agreed to the Burisma-Biden investigation, or as an effort to increase the pressure on them to do so. On September 5th, I took notes at Senator Johnson and Senator Chris Murphy's meetings with President Zelensky in Kyiv, where President Zelensky asked about the security assistance. Although both senators stressed strong bipartisan congressional support for Ukraine, Senator Johnson cautioned President Zelensky that President Trump has a negative view of Ukraine and that President Zelensky would have a difficult time overcoming it. Senator Johnson further explained that he had been, quote, shocked by President Trump's negative reaction during an Oval Office meeting on May 23rd when he and the three amigos proposed that President Trump meet President Zelensky and show support for Ukraine. On September 8th, Ambassador Taylor told me, quote, now they're insisting Zelensky commit to the investigation in an interview with CNN, which I took to refer to the three amigos. I was shocked the requirement was so specific and concrete. While we had advised our Ukrainian counterparts to voice a commitment to following the rule of law and generally investigating credible corruption allegations, this was a demand that President Zelensky personally commit on a cable news channel to a specific investigation of President Trump's political rival. On September 11th, the hold was finally lifted after significant press coverage and bipartisan congressional expressions of concern about the withholding of security assistance. Although we knew the hold was lifted, we were still concerned that President Zelensky had committed, in exchange for the lifting, to give the requested CNN an interview. We had several indications that the interview would occur. First, the Yes Conference in Kyiv was held from September 12th to 14th, and CNN's Fareed Zakaria was one of the moderators. Second, on September 13th, an embassy colleague received a phone call from another colleague who worked for Ambassador Sondland. My colleague texted me regarding that call that, quote, Sondland and the Zelensky interview, Sondland said the Zelensky interview is supposed to be today or Monday, and they plan to announce that a certain investigation that was on hold will progress. Sondland's aide did not know if this was decided or if Sondland was advocating for it. Apparently, he's been discussing this with Yermak. Finally, also on September 13th, Ambassador Taylor and I ran into Mr. Yermak on our way out of a meeting with President Zelensky in his private office. Ambassador Taylor again stressed the importance of staying out of U.S. politics and said he hoped no interview was planned. Mr. Yermak did not answer, but shrugged in resignation as if to indicate that he had no choice. In short, everybody thought there was going to be an interview and that the Ukrainians believed they had to do it. The interview ultimately did not occur. On September 21st, Ambassador Taylor and I collaborated on input he sent to Mr. Morrison to brief President Trump ahead of a September 25th meeting that had been scheduled with President Zelensky in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly. The transcript of the July 25th call was released the same day. As of today, I have still not seen a readout of the September 25th meeting. As the impeachment inquiry has progressed, I have followed press reports and reviewed the statements of Ambassadors Taylor and Yovanovitch. Based on my experiences in Ukraine, my recollection is generally consistent with their testimony, and I believe that the relevant facts were therefore being laid out for the American people. However, in the last couple weeks, I read press reports expressing for the first time that certain senior officials may have been acting without the president's knowledge or freelancing in their dealings with Ukraine. At the same time, I also read reports noting the lack of firsthand evidence in the investigation and suggesting that the only evidence being elicited at the hearings was hearsay. I came to realize that I had firsthand knowledge regarding certain events on July 26 that had not otherwise been reported, and that those events potentially bore on the question of whether the president did, in fact, have knowledge that those senior officials were using the levers of diplomatic power to influence the new Ukrainian president to announce the opening of a criminal investigation against President Trump's political opponent. It is at that point that I made the observation to Ambassador Taylor that the incident I had witnessed on July 26th had acquired greater significance, which is what he reported in his testimony last week and is what led to the subpoena for me to appear here today. In conclusion, I'd like to take a moment to turn back to Ukraine. Today, this very day, marks exactly 6 years since throngs of pro-Western Ukrainians spontaneously gathered on Kyiv's Independence Square to launch what became known as the Revolution of Dignity. While the protests began in opposition to a turn towards Russia and away from the West, they expanded over 3 months to reject the entire corrupt, repressive system that had been sustained by Russian influence in the country. Those events were followed by Russia's occupation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, an invasion of Ukraine's eastern Donbas region, and an ensuing war that to date has cost almost 14,000 lives. Despite the Russian aggression over the past 5 years, Ukrainians have rebuilt a shattered economy, adhered to a peace process, and moved economically and socially closer to the West, toward our way of life. Earlier this year, large majorities of Ukrainians again chose a fresh start by voting for a political newcomer as president, replacing 80% of their parliament, and endorsing a platform consistent with our democratic values, our reform priorities, and our strategic interests. This year's revolution at the ballot box underscores that despite its imperfections, Ukraine is a genuine and vibrant democracy and an example to other post-Soviet countries and beyond, from Moscow to Hong Kong. How we respond to this historic opportunity will set the trajectory of our relationship with Ukraine and will define our willingness to defend our bedrock international principles and our leadership role in the world. Ukrainians want to hear a clear and unambiguous reaffirmation that our long-standing bipartisan policy of strong support for Ukraine remains unchanged, and that we fully back it at the highest levels. Now is not the time to retreat from our relationship with Ukraine, but rather to double down on it. As we sit here today, Ukrainians are fighting a hot war on Ukrainian territory against Russian aggression. This week alone, since I have been here in Washington, two Ukrainian soldiers were killed and two injured by Russian-led forces in eastern Ukraine despite a declared ceasefire. I learned overnight that seven more were injured yesterday. As Vice President Pence said after his meeting with President Zelensky in Warsaw, the U.S.-Ukraine relationship has never been stronger. Ukrainians and their new government earnestly want to believe that. Ukrainians cherish their bipartisan American support that has sustained their Euro-Atlantic aspirations, and they recoil at the thought of playing a role in U.S. domestic politics or elections. At a time of shifting allegiances and rising competitors in the world, we have no better friends than Ukraine, a scrappy, unbowed, determined, and above all, dignified people who are standing up against Russian authoritarianism and aggression. They deserve better. We're now at an inflection point in Ukraine, and it is critical to our national security that we stand in strong support of our Ukrainian partners. Ukrainians and freedom-loving people everywhere are watching the example we set here of democracy and the rule of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. Dr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do I need to adjust the microphone?
Is the microphone on?
I believe it is now. Is that right?
Yes, perfect.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Nunes and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to testify before you today. I have a short opening statement. I appreciate the importance of Congress's impeachment inquiry, and I am appearing today as a fact witness, as I did during my deposition on October 14th, in order to answer your questions about what I saw, what I did, what I knew, and what I know with regard to the subjects of your inquiry. I believe that those who have information that the Congress deems relevant have a legal and a moral obligation to provide it. I take great pride in the fact that I'm a non-partisan foreign policy expert who has served under three Republican and Democratic presidents. I have no interest in advancing the outcome of your inquiry in any particular direction except toward the truth. I will not provide a long narrative statement because I believe that the interest of Congress and the American people is best served by allowing you to ask me your questions. And I'm happy to expand upon my October 14th deposition testimony in response to your questions today. But before I do so, I'd like to communicate two things. First, I'd like to share a little bit about who I am. I'm an American by choice, having become a citizen in 2002. I was born in the northeast of England, in the same region that George Washington's ancestors came from. Both my region and my family have deep ties to the United States. My paternal grandfather fought through World War I in the Royal Field Artillery, surviving being shot, shelled, and gassed before American troops intervened to end the war in 1918. During the Second World War, other members of my family fought to defend the free world from fascism alongside American soldiers, sailors, and airmen. The men in my father's family were coal miners, whose families always struggled with poverty. When my father, Alfred, was 14, he joined his father, brothers, brother, uncles and cousins in the coal mines to help put food on the table. When the last of the local mines closed in the 1960s, my father wanted to emigrate to the United States to work in the coal mines in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. But his mother, my grandmother, had been crippled from hard labor, and my father couldn't leave. So he stayed in northern England until he died in 2012. My mother still lives in my hometown today. While his dream of emigrating to America was thwarted, my father loved America, its culture, its history, and its role as a beacon of hope for the world. He always wanted someone in the family to make it to the United States. I began my university studies in 1984, and I just learned that I went to the same university as my colleague here, Mr. Holmes, in St. Andrews in Scotland. I just thought I would add that. And in 1987, I won a place on an academic exchange to the Soviet Union. I was there for the signing of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty, and when President Ronald Reagan met Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in Moscow. This was a turning point for me. An American professor who I met there told me about graduate student scholarships to the United States. And the very next year, thanks to his advice, I arrived in America to start my advanced studies at Harvard. Years later, I can say with confidence that this country has offered me opportunities I never would have had in England. I grew up poor, with a very distinctive working-class accent. In England, in the 1980s and 1990s, this would have impeded my professional advancement. This background has never set me back in America. For the best part of three decades, I've built a career as a non-partisan, non-political national security professional focusing on Europe and Eurasia, and especially the former Soviet Union. I've served our country under three presidents, in my most recent capacity under President Trump, as well as in my former position under my former position of National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. In that role, I was the intelligence community's senior expert on Russia and the former Soviet republics, including Ukraine. It was because of my background and experience that I was asked to join the National Security Council in 2017. At the NSC, Russia was part of my portfolio, but I was also responsible for coordinating US policy for all of Western Europe, all of Eastern Europe, including Ukraine and Turkey, along with NATO and the European Union. I was hired initially by General Michael Flynn, Katie McFarland, and General Keith Kellogg. But then I started work in April 2017 when General McMaster was the National Security Advisor. I, and they, thought that I could help them with President Trump's stated goal of improving relations with Russia, while still implementing policies designed to deter Russian conduct that threatens the United States, including the unprecedented and successful Russian operation to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. This relates to the second thing I want to communicate. Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016. This is the public conclusion of our intelligence agencies, confirmed in bipartisan congressional reports. It is beyond dispute, even if some of the underlying details must remain classified. The impact of the successful 2016 Russian campaign remains evident today. Our nation is being torn apart. Truth is questioned. Our highly professional and expert Korea Foreign Service is being undermined. U.S. support for Ukraine, which continues to face armed Russian aggression, has been politicized. The Russian government's goal is to weaken our country, to diminish America's global role, and to neutralize a perceived U.S. threat to Russian interests. President Putin and the Russian security services aim to counter U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe, including in Ukraine, where Moscow wishes to reassert political and economic dominance. I say this not as an alarmist, but as a realist. I do not think long-term conflict with Russia is either desirable or inevitable. I continue to believe that we need to seek ways of stabilizing our relationship with Moscow, even as we counter their efforts to harm us. Right now, Russia's security services and their proxies have geared up to repeat their interference in the 2020 election. We are running out of time to stop them. In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests. As Republicans and Democrats have agreed for decades, Ukraine is a valued partner of the United States, and it plays an important role in our national security. And as I told the committee last month, I refuse to be part of an effort to legitimize an alternate narrative that the Ukrainian government is a U.S. adversary and that Ukraine, not Russia, attacked us in 2016. These fictions are harmful even if they are deployed for purely domestic political purposes. President Putin and the Russian security services operate like a super PAC. They deploy millions of dollars to weaponize our own political opposition research and false narratives. When we are consumed by partisan rancor, we cannot combat these external forces as they seek to divide us against each other, degrade our institutions, and destroy the faith of the American people in our democracy. I respect the work that this Congress does in carrying out its constitutional responsibilities, including this inquiry, and I'm here to help you to the best of my ability. If the President or anyone else impedes or subverts the national security of the United States in order to further domestic, political, or personal interests, that's more than worthy of your attention. But we must not let domestic politics stop us from defending ourselves against the foreign powers who truly wish us harm. I'm ready to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hill. We'll now proceed to the first round of questions. As detailed in the memo provided to committee members, there will be 45 minutes of questions conducted by the chairman or majority counsel, followed by 45 minutes for the ranking member or minority counsel. Following that, unless I specify additional equal time for extended questioning, we'll proceed under the five-minute rule, and every member will have a chance to ask questions. I now recognize myself or majority counsel for the first round of questions. First of all, thank you both for being here. Thank you for testifying. Dr. Hill, your story reminds me a great deal of what we heard from Alexander Vindman. The few immigrant stories that we have heard just in the course of these hearings are among the most powerful, I think, I've ever heard. You and Dr. and Colonel Vindman and others are the best of this country, and you came here by choice, and we are so blessed that you did. So welcome. My colleagues took some umbrage with your opening statement, but I think the American people can be forgiven if they have the same impression, listening to some of the statements of my colleagues during this hearing, that Russia didn't intervene in our election. It was all the Ukrainians. There's an effort to take a tweet here and an op-ed there and a newspaper story here, and somehow equate it with the systemic intervention that our intelligence agencies found that Russia perpetrated in 2016 through an extensive social media campaign and a hacking and dumping operation. Indeed, the report my colleagues gave you that they produced during the investigation calls into question the accuracy of the Intelligence Committee's finding that Russia intervened to help one side, to help Donald Trump at the expense of Hillary Clinton. No one in the intelligence community questions that finding. Nor does the FBI, nor does the Senate Bipartisan Intelligence Committee report, nor does the Minority Committee report of this committee. The House Republican report is an outlier. But let me ask you, Dr. Hill, about your concern with that Russian narrative. that it wasn't the Russians that engaged in interfering in our election in 2016. And of course, this was given a boost when President Trump in Helsinki, in the presence of Putin, said that he questioned his own intelligence agencies. But why are the Russians pushing that narrative that it was Ukraine? How does that serve Russian interests?
The Russians' interests, frankly, are to delegitimize our entire presidency. So one issue that I do want to raise, and I think that this would resonate with our colleagues on the committee from the Republican Party, is that the goal of the Russians was really to put whoever became the president, by trying to tip their hands on one side of the scale, under a cloud. So if Secretary, former First Lady, former Senator Clinton had been elected as president, as indeed many expected in the run-up to the election in 2016, she too would have had major questions about her legitimacy. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing here as a result of all of these narratives, as this is exactly what the Russian government was hoping for. If they seed misinformation, they seed doubt, they have everybody questioning the legitimacy of a presidential candidate, be it President Trump or potentially a President Clinton, that they would pit one side of our electorate against the other, that they would pit one party against the other. And that's why I wanted to make such a strong point at the very beginning. Because there were certainly individuals in many other countries who had harsh words for both of the candidates, who had harsh words for many other candidates during the primaries. We had a lot of people who were running for president on the Republican side. There were many people who were trying themselves to game the outcome. As you know, in the United Kingdom, the bookies take bets. You can go to Ladbrokes or William Hill and lay a bet on who you think is going to be the candidate. So the Russian government were trying to lay in their own bets. But what they wanted to do was give a spread. They wanted to make sure that whoever they had bet on or whoever they'd tried to tip the scales would also experience some discomfort, that they would be beholden to them in some way, that they would create just the kind of chaos that we have seen in our politics. So I just want to again emphasize that we need to be very careful as we discuss all of these issues, not to give them more fodder that they can use against us in 2020.
And I quite agree. There's an additional benefit, and I think you're absolutely right. The Russians are equal opportunity meddlers. They will not only help one side, but they'll also just seek to sow discord in the United States along ethnic lines, religious lines, geographic lines. But there's also a benefit now, isn't there, for Russia to put the blame on Ukraine, to cast doubt on whether they intervened at all in our election and blame it on a U.S. ally as a way of driving a wedge between the U.S. and Ukraine. Isn't that true?
Well, that's absolutely the case. And in fact, you just made the point about U.S. allies. The Russians like to put a lot of blame on U.S. allies for incidents that they have perpetrated. We saw that recently with the United Kingdom in the Russian Secret Service's attack on a former spy, Mr. Skripal, and his daughter in Salisbury in England, where you may recall that the Russians actually accused the British government of perpetrating this themselves. So this falls into a long pattern of deflection and of the Russian government trying to pin the blame on someone else. And as my colleague Mr. Holmes here has laid out, the Russians have a particular vested interest in putting Ukraine and Ukrainians and Ukrainian leaders in a very bad light. All of the issues that we started to discuss today and that you on the committee have been deeply involved in began with Russia's illegal annexation of the peninsula of Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. In response and in 2015 and all of the different acts of aggression that Russia has engaged in since, starting a war in the Donbass, shooting down Russian operatives, a plane MH17 over the Donbass at a later period, there is a great deal of hostility and malign intent towards Ukraine, and it suits the Russian government very much if we are also looking at Ukraine as somehow a perpetrator of malign acts against us.
Thank you. Mr. Holmes, I want to ask you a quick couple of questions, and I think as often is the case for people, I was obviously at your deposition, I've read your opening testimony, but as you learn more facts, you start to see things in a different light. Even though your opening statement is very much consistent with your opening statement during the deposition. And I was struck in particular by something you said on page 10 of your opening statement. While we had advised our Ukrainian counterparts to voice a commitment to following the rule of law and generally investigating credible corruption allegations, this was a demand that President Zelensky personally commit on a cable news channel
to a specific investigation of President Trump's political rival. This gets to a point I made at the close of our hearing yesterday about hypocrisy. Here we are, and we are urging Ukrainians to commit to following the rule of law, as you said, and only investigate genuine and credible allegations. And what are we doing? We're asking them to investigate the president's political rival. Ukrainians are pretty sophisticated actors, aren't they? They can recognize hypocrisy when they see it. What does that do to our anti-corruption efforts when the Ukrainians perceive that we're engaging in corruption ourselves?
Yes, sir. So our long-standing policy is to encourage them to establish and build rule of law institutions that are capable and that are independent and that can actually pursue credible allegations. That's our policy, and we've been doing that for quite some time with some success. So focusing on particular cases, including particular cases where there is a interest of the president, it's just not part of what we've done. It's hard to explain why we would do that.
Well, it harkens back to that conversation Ambassador Volker testified about when he urged Ukraine not to investigate or prosecute Poroshenko, and the reply from Mr. Yermak was, oh, you mean like you want us to do with the Bidens and the Clintons? They're sophisticated enough actors to recognize when we're saying do as we say, not as we do, are they not?
Yes, sir.
You also, in your testimony, and I was struck by this anew today, when even after the aid is lifted, Ukraine still felt pressure to make these statements. And you and Ambassador Taylor were worried that they were going to do it on CNN. And you said that Ambassador Taylor again stressed the importance of staying out of U.S. politics and said he hoped no interview was planned. Mr. Yermak did not answer but shrugged in resignation as if to indicate that they had no choice. In short, everyone thought there was going to be an interview and that the Ukrainians believed they had to do it. So you're acknowledging, I think, Mr. Holmes, are you not, that Ukraine very much felt pressured to undertake these investigations, that the president, Rudy Giuliani, and Ambassador Sondland and others were demanding?
Yes, sir. And although the hold on the security assistance may have been lifted, there were still things they wanted that they weren't getting, including a meeting with the president in the Oval Office. Whether the hold, the security assistance hold continued or not, the Ukrainians understood that that's something the president wanted, and they still wanted important things from the president. So and I think that continues to this day. I think they're being very careful. They still need us now going forward. In fact, right now, President Zelensky is trying to arrange a summit meeting with President Putin in the coming weeks, to his first face-to-face meeting with him to try to advance the peace process. He needs our support. He needs President Putin to understand that America supports Zelensky at the highest levels. So this doesn't end with the lifting of the security assistance hold. Ukraine still needs us, and as I said, still fighting this war this very day.
Well, and I would underscore again, as my colleague did so eloquently, they got caught. That's the reason the aid was finally lifted. Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to both of you. Yesterday we heard testimony from Ambassador Gordon Sondland from the European Union, who testified that President Trump wanted Ukraine to announce the investigations into the Bidens of Burisma and the 2016 elections because they would benefit him politically, and that he used the leverage of that White House meeting and the security assistance to pressure President Zelensky to do so. Dr. Hill, you testified, I believe, that in mid-June, Ambassador Sondland told you that he was in charge of Ukraine policy. Is that right?
That's correct, sir, yes.
Who did he tell you had put him in charge of Ukraine policy?
He told me it was the president.
Mr. Holmes, did you also understand that Ambassador Sondland had been given some authority over Ukraine policy from the president?
We understood that he had been told to work with Mr. Giuliani.
And did he hold himself out as having direct contact and knowledge of the president's priorities and interests?
Yes, sir.
Now, Mr. Holmes, I'm going to go to that July 26th date when you overheard the conversation between Ambassador Sondland and President Trump. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you a little bit about the lead-up to that conversation. Before the lunch that you described, you said that you accompanied Ambassador Sondland, Volker, and Taylor to a meeting with President Zelensky. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you took notes at that meeting?
Yes, sir.
And you reviewed those notes before you came here to testify today?
Yes.
And they were helpful to refresh your recollection as to what happened. Is that right?
Yes.
During that meeting, President Zelensky said that on his phone call with President Trump the previous day, that three times President Trump had mentioned sensitive issues. Did you understand what President Zelensky was referring to when he said the sensitive issues?
I couldn't be sure what he was referring to until I later read the transcript of the July 25th call, but I was aware of various contacts between the three amigos and his government about this set of issues.
And after you read the call, what did you determine to be the sensitive issues that President Zelensky referenced?
The Burisma-Biden investigation.
After this meeting with President Zelensky, you testified that Ambassador Sondland had a one-on-one meeting with Andrei Yermak, a top aide to Zelensky, and that you were prohibited from going into that meeting to take notes. Is that right?
Yes.
And yesterday, Ambassador Sondland testified that he probably discussed the investigations with Mr. Yermak. Did Ambassador Sondland tell you at all what they discussed?
He did not.
Now, after this meeting with Mr. Yermak, you went to lunch. And can you just describe where you were sitting at the restaurant?
Yes, sir. The restaurant has sort of glass doors that open onto a terrace. And we were at the first tables on the terrace, so immediately outside of the interior of the restaurant. The doors were all wide open. There was tables, table for four, all I recall it being two tables for two pushed together. In any case, it was quite a wide table. And the table was set with sort of a table runner down the middle. I was directly across from Ambassador Sondland. We were close enough that we could, you know, share an appetizer between us, and then the two staffers were off to our right at this next table.
Now, you said that at some point Ambassador Sondland pulled out his cell phone and called President Trump. This was an unsecure cell phone, is that right?
Yes, sir.
In the middle of a restaurant in Kyiv?
Yes.
Now, you said that you were able to hear President Trump's voice through the receiver. How were you able to hear if it was not on speakerphone?
Yeah, it was several things. It was quite loud when the president came on, quite distinctive. I believe Ambassador Sondland also said yesterday he often speaks very loudly over the phone, and I certainly experienced that. When the president came on, he sort of winced and held the phone away from his ear like this, and he did that for the first couple exchanges. I don't know if he then turned the volume down, if he got used to it, if the president moderated his volume. I don't know. But that's how I was able to hear it.
And so you were able to hear some of what President Trump said to President Zelensky. Is that right?
The first portion of the conversation, yes.
And what did you hear President Trump say to, not President Zelensky, to Ambassador Sondland?
What I hear
the president say to Ambassador Sondland.
Yeah, he clarified whether he was in Ukraine or not, and he said, yes, I'm here in Ukraine. And then Ambassador Sondland said he loves your ass, he'll do anything you want. He said he's going to do the investigation.
So you heard President Trump ask Ambassador Sondland, is he going to do the investigation?
Yes, sir.
What was Ambassador Sondland's response?
He said, oh, yeah, he's going to do it. He'll do anything you ask.
And was that the end of the Ukraine portion of the conversation?
Yes.
Afterwards, you described a follow-on conversation that you had with Ambassador Sondland, where you asked him, I think, generally, what did President Trump think of Ukraine? Is that right?
Correct.
What did Ambassador Sondland say to you?
He said he doesn't really care about Ukraine.
Did he use slightly more colorful language than that?
He did.
What did he say that he does care about?
He said he cares about big stuff.
Did he explain what he meant by big stuff?
Well, I asked him, well, what kind of big stuff? We have big stuff going on here, like a war with Russia. And he said, no, big stuff, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani is pushing.
Now, Were you familiar with the Biden investigation that he referenced at that point?
Yes, sir.
And how do you have such a specific and clear recollection of this conversation with the president and your conversation with Ambassador Sondland?
Yeah. So this was a very distinctive experience. I've never seen anything like this in my Foreign Service career. Someone at a lunch in a restaurant making a call on a cell phone to the President of the United States. Being able to hear his voice, it's a very distinctive personality, so you've all seen him on television. Very colorful language was used. They were directly addressing something that I had been wondering about working on for weeks and even months. A topic that had led to the recall of my former boss, the former ambassador. And so here was a person who said he had direct contact with the president and had said that over the course of time. Here he is actually having that contact with the president, hearing the president's voice, and them talking about this issue of the Biden investigation that I'd been hearing about.
So just to summarize, during this, the phone call that you overheard Ambassador Sondland have with President Trump, mm-hmm. you heard President Trump himself ask, the only question that you really heard him ask, I believe, is whether he was going to do the investigation. To which Ambassador Sondland responded that he would, and he would in fact do anything that President Zelensky wants. Is that an accurate recitation of what happened?
That's correct.
And then after that call, you had a subsequent conversation with Ambassador Sondland where he, in sum and substance, told you that the president doesn't care about Ukraine. He only cares about big stuff related to himself and particularly the Biden investigation that Giuliani was pushing.
Correct.
Now, a day before your lunch with Ambassador Sondland, President Trump did speak with President Zelensky, as you referred, and certainly the president made it clear to President Zelensky that he cared about the Biden investigation. Now, neither of you did listen to this call, but as you testified, you both read it subsequent to its publication. Dr. Hill, you, during your time, 2.5 years in the White House, listened to a number of presidential phone calls. Is that right?
That's right.
Can you estimate approximately how many?
I can't, actually. I mean, sometimes there would be multiple calls during a week. I was there for more than 2 years, so it's a fair number.
Have you ever heard a call like this one that you read?
I don't want to comment on this call because this is, in my view, executive privilege.
Counsel.
In terms of the testimony, yes.
I think that as a threshold matter, I think that there are issues of classification regarding head of state communications that we do want to be sensitive to in this forum, among other issues.
Understood. I'm really just focused on this one call that has been declassified and published, and just asking you whether you'd ever heard any presidential phone call along these lines.
Well, again, I'd like to just focus in this testimony on this particular call, and I will just say that I found this particular call subject matter and the way that it was conducted surprising.
You said in your deposition testimony that you were very shocked and very saddened to read it.
That's correct.
Why was that?
Because the nature of the discussion, the juxtaposition of the issues in which they were raised, and also given the fact that I myself had actually opposed, along with Ambassador Bolt for some period, having a call, unless it was very well prepared, and that we were confident that the issues that Ukraine and the United States were most generally together interested in were going to be raised. And I saw in this call that this was not the case.
You also testified that you were concerned that this call was turning a White House meeting into some kind of asset. Do you recall that testimony?
I don't think it was specifically about that call, but I recall the testimony because this was clearly the discussion preceding the call. Remember, I left on July 19th and the call took place the following week. In the months leading up to that, from May onwards, it became very clear that the White House meeting itself was being predicated on other issues, namely investigations and the questions about the election interference in 2016.
Mr. Holmes, you indicate in your opening statement that The chief of staff to President Zelensky had indicated to you that in this phone call on July 25th, there was a discussion about personnel issues related to the prosecutor general's office. After you read the call, did you understand who and what that was referring to?
Yes, sir. In that brief meeting with the chief of staff, it was very confusing to me why, in the few minutes we had, why that would have been the issue he raised. So it wasn't until I read the transcript of the call on the 25th that I understood that the president had specifically mentioned Prosecutor General Lutsenko, who the Zelensky administration was in the process of replacing and carving out all his sort of underlings who had been collaborating with him on some of the corruption we saw there.
And I believe you also said that President Lutsenko was the source of some of Mr. Giuliani's public views and allegations. Is that right?
Yes, sir. So about 2 weeks before the press kind of wave that we saw targeting Ambassador Yovanovitch became public, an embassy contact had reported to us privately that Mr. Lutsenko was sending these messages and had met with an American journalist to try to get those messages out.
What was the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine's view of Prosecutor General Lutsenko?
He was not a good partner. He had failed to deliver on the promised reforms that he had committed to when he took office. And he was using his office to insulate and protect political allies while presumably enriching himself.
Is another way to describe that corrupt?
Yes.
Now, I'm going to take a look at a couple of excerpts from this July 25th call with you. And the first one occurs right after President Zelensky thanked President Trump for the United States' support in the area of defense. And President Trump immediately then says, "I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server. They say Ukraine has it." Now, Dr. Hill, is this a reference to this debunked conspiracy theory about Ukraine interference in the 2016 election that you discussed at the in your opening statement as well as with Chairman Schiff?
The reference to CrowdStrike and the server, yes, that's correct.
And it is your understanding that there is no basis for these allegations, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, isn't it also true that some of President Trump's most senior advisors had informed him that this theory of Ukraine interference in the 2016 election was false?
That's correct.
So is it your understanding then that President Trump disregarded the advice of his senior officials about this theory and instead listened to Rudy Giuliani's views?
That appears to be the case, yes.
And I also then want to just show one other exhibit that goes back to what you were testifying earlier, Dr. Hill, about Russia's interest in promoting this theory. This is an excerpt from a February 2nd, 2017 news conference between with President Putin and Prime Minister Orban of Hungary, where Putin says, "Second, as we all know, during the presidential campaign in the United States, the Ukrainian government adopted a unilateral position in favor of one candidate. More than that, certain oligarchs, certainly with the approval of the political leadership, funded this candidate, or female candidate, to be more precise." Mr. Holmes, you spent 3 years as well in the U.S. Embassy in Russia. Why would it be to Vladimir Putin's advantage to promote this theory of Ukraine interference?
First of all, to deflect from the allegations of Russian interference. Second of all, to drive a wedge between the United States and Ukraine, which Russia wants to essentially get back into its sphere of influence. Thirdly, to besmirch Ukraine and its political leadership, to degrade and erode support for Ukraine from other key partners in Europe and elsewhere.
And Dr. Hill, by promoting this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election, was President Trump adopting Vladimir Putin's view over his own senior advisors and intelligence officials?
I think we have to be very careful about the way that we phrase that. This is a view that President Putin and the Russian security services and many actors in Russia have promoted. But I think that this view has also got some traction, perhaps in parallel and separately here in the United States. And those two things have, over time, started to fuse together.
Well, back in May of this year, do you recall that President Trump had a phone conversation in early May with President Putin?
I do.
And that he also then met in mid-May with Prime Minister Orban, who had joined President Putin at this press conference?
That's correct.
Now, that happened in between the time when President Zelensky was elected on April 21st and his inauguration on May 20th. Is that right?
Correct.
And in fact, President, isn't it true that President Trump had asked Vice President Pence to attend the inauguration after his phone call with President Zelensky on April 21st?
I'm not sure that I can say that President Trump had asked the Vice President Pence. I was not in any meeting in which that took place. I can say that I myself and many others at the NSC and in the State Department were quite keen, very eager to have Vice President Pence go to Ukraine to represent the United States government and the president.
And is that also your recollection, Mr. Holmes, that you wanted Vice President Pence to attend?
Yes, sir, and we understood that that was the plan.
Now, Jennifer Williams from the office of the Vice President testified here that on May 13th, which is the same day that President Trump met with Prime Minister Orban, that the president called off Vice President Pence's trip for unknown reasons, but before the inauguration date had been scheduled. And Dr. Hill, were you aware also that, during that period there was a lot of publicity, and I think, Mr. Holmes, you referenced this in your opening statement as well, about Rudy Giuliani's interest in these investigations in Ukraine?
I was certainly aware, yes.
And the around this time, Dr. Hill, you also, I believe, testified that Ambassador Bolton had expressed some views to you about Mr. Giuliani's interest in Ukraine. Do you recall what you said?
Yes.
What he said to you, rather?
I do recall, yes. It was part of a conversation about the things that Mr. Giuliani was saying very frequently in public. We saw them often, or saw him often on television making these statements. And I had already brought to Ambassador Bolton's attention the attacks, the smear campaign against Ambassador Yovanovitch, and expressed great regret about how this was unfolding and, in fact, the shameful way in which Ambassador Yovanovitch was being smeared and attacked. And I'd asked if there was anything that we could do about it. And Ambassador Bolton had looked pained, basically indicated with body language that there was nothing which we could do about it. And he then, in the course of that discussion, said that Rudy Giuliani was a hand grenade that was going to blow everyone up.
Did you understand what he meant by that?
I did, actually.
What did he mean?
Well, I think he meant that, obviously, what Mr. Giuliani was saying was pretty explosive in any case. He was frequently on television making quite incendiary remarks about everyone involved in this, and that he was clearly pushing forward issues and ideas that would, you know, probably come back to haunt us. And, in fact, I think that that's where we are today.
Now, Mr. Holmes, did the Ukrainians understand that Rudy Giuliani represented the president's views?
I believe they did. First, he was reaching out to them directly. He also, Ambassador Yovanovitch's removal, I think, is relevant to this portion of the inquiry, because she was removed following this media campaign in which Rudy Giuliani and his associates were very prominent, and criticizing her for not taking seriously some of the theories and issues that later came up. And so when she was removed, commentators in Ukraine believed that Lutsenko, working with Giuliani, had succeeded in getting her removed. So they were already aware of Mr. Giuliani and his influence, the issues that he was promoting, and ultimately that he was able to get an ambassador removed. partly because of that. So he was someone to contend with. And then in addition, immediately after the inauguration, he began reaching out to the Zelensky administration, key figures in the Zelensky administration, and continue to do that.
Let's focus on the inauguration for a minute. You escorted, for lack of a better word, the U.S. delegation around?
So I joined them in some of their meetings, but not for the entire day.
And who was the official, who was on the official delegation?
Yes, sir. It was five people. So it was the head of the delegation was Secretary Perry. And then it was Ambassador Volker representing the State Department, Ambassador Sondland, our temporary chargé, Joseph Pennington, and Alex Vindman representing the White House.
And did the delegation have a meeting with President Zelensky that you attended?
Yes.
And you testified, I think, in your previously that Secretary Perry gave a list of some sort to President Zelensky at that meeting. Do you recall that?
Yes. In the meeting with the president, Secretary Perry is the head of the delegation, opened the meeting for the American side, and had a number of points he made. And during that period, he handed over a piece of paper. I did not see what was on the paper, but Secretary Perry described what was on the paper as a list of trusted individuals and recommended that President Zelensky could draw from that list for advice on energy sector reform issues.
And do you know who was on that list?
I didn't see the list. I don't know other colleagues. There are other people who have been in the mix for a while on that set of issues. Other people Secretary Perry has mentioned as being people to consult on reform.
And are they Americans?
Yes.
Now, do you also recall that Colonel Vindman spoke to President Zelensky in that meeting?
Yes.
And what did he say to President Zelensky in terms of some of the issues that we're addressing here in this investigation?
Yes, sir. He was the last to speak. He made a general point about the importance of Ukraine to our national security, and he said it's very important that the Zelensky administration stay out of U.S. domestic politics.
Was it your understanding that President Zelensky and the Ukrainians were already starting to feel some pressure to conduct these political investigations?
Yes.
And those were the ones related to Biden and Burisma in the 2016 election?
Correct.
Now, Dr. Hill, you also testified that around this same time in May, you learned that President Trump was receiving information from someone else at the National Security Council. Is that right?
That's not quite right. I was told in passing that someone else at the National Security Council, that the president may want to speak to them because of some materials related to Ukraine.
And did that person indicate that the president thought that was the director of Ukraine?
That was correct. It was a very brief conversation, just to be clear.
Who is the director of Ukraine?
The director for Ukraine is Alex Vindman, Colonel Vindman.
And who did the this individual in the executive secretary's office refer to?
The individual just said the name Cash.
And did you know who that was?
Initially, when I was thinking about it, I had to search my mind, and the only Cash that I knew at the National Security Council was Cash Patel.
And Cash Patel did not work on Ukraine matters that you oversaw, is that right?
Not that I oversaw, no.
So the indication is that Cash Patel had provided some information directly to the president without your knowledge?
That seemed to be the indication.
Now, I want to go back to the July 25th call right now, where President Trump, in another excerpt, asked President Zelensky about his potential political opponent, Vice President Joe Biden. In this excerpt, the president said, "The other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it." It sounds horrible to me. Now, Dr. Hill, this was, of course, one of the allegations that Rudy Giuliani was pushing. Is that right?
That's correct.
And now confirmed in this July 25th call that the president was also interested in it?
Yes.
Ambassadors Volker and Sondland have tried to draw a distinction between their understanding of the connection between Burisma and the Bidens. But Dr. Hill, was it apparent to you that when President Trump, Rudy Giuliani, or anyone else was pushing for an investigation into Burisma, that the reason why they wanted that investigation related to what President Trump said here, the Bidens?
It was very apparent to me that that was what Rudy Giuliani intended, yes, intended to convey that Burisma was linked to the Bidens, and he said this publicly, repeatedly.
And Mr. Holmes, you also understood that Burisma was code for Bidens?
Yes.
And do you think that anyone involved in Ukraine matters in the spring and the summer would understand that as well?
Yes.
Now, are either, Dr. Hill, are you aware of any evidence to support the allegations against Vice President Biden?
I am not, no.
And in fact, Mr. Holmes, the former prosecutor general of Ukraine, who Vice President Biden encouraged to fire, was actually corrupt, is that right?
Correct.
And was not pursuing corruption investigations and prosecutions, right?
My understanding is the prosecutor general at the time, Shokin, was not at that time pursuing investigations of Burisma or the Bidens.
And in fact, removing that corrupt prosecutor general was part of the United States anti-corruption policy, isn't that correct?
That's correct, and not just us, but all of our allies and other institutions that were involved in Ukraine at the time.
Now, Dr. Hill, you indicated earlier that you had understood that a White House meeting was conditioned on the pursuit by Ukraine of these investigations. And I want to focus on the July 10th meeting in the White House where that came to light. You indicated that in your testimony that there was a large meeting that Ambassador Bolton ran where Ambassadors Sondland, Volker, and Secretary Perry also attended. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And why were they included in that meeting with two Ukrainian officials about national security matters?
Well, the initial intent had not been to include them. We'd anticipated that the two Ukrainian officials would have a number of meetings, as is usually the procedure, and that there would be meetings at the State Department, potentially also at the Energy Department. And then there was a request to have Ambassadors Sondland and Volker included, coming directly from their offices. And as a result of that, clearly given the important role that Secretary Perry was playing in the energy sector reform in Ukraine and the fact that he'd also been in the delegation to the presidential inauguration in Ukraine, we decided that it would be better than to include all three of them.
Now, toward the end of this meeting, the Ukrainians raised their ongoing desire for an Oval Office meeting. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what happened after they did that?
Well, I listened very carefully to Ambassador Sondland's testimony yesterday, so I want to actually point out something where I think it's easy to explain why he had a different interpretation of how this came into being. The meeting had initially been scheduled for about 45, minutes to an hour. And it was definitely in the wrap-up phase of the meeting when this occurred. We'd gone through a series of discussions. Alexander Danilyuk, who was at this point the designated National Security Advisor of Ukraine, really wanted to get into the weeds of how you might reform a National Security Council. He talked to me about this prior to the meeting, and he was hoping, to have this opportunity with the National Security Advisor of the United States to get his first-hand opinions and thoughts on what might happen. We'd also wanted to go through a discussion about how important it was for Ukraine to get its energy sector reform underway. And clearly, Secretary Perry had some talking points for this. This is an issue that Ambassador Bolton was also interested in. And then we knew that the Ukrainians would have on their agenda, inevitably, the question about a meeting. And so as we get through the main discussion, we're going into that wrap-up phase. The Ukrainians, Mr. Danilyuk, starts to ask about a White House meeting. And Ambassador Bolton was trying to parry this back. Although he's the National Security Advisor, he's not in charge of scheduling the meeting. We have input recommending the meetings, and this goes through a whole process. So it's not Ambassador Bolton's role to start pulling out the schedule and start saying, right, well, we're going to look and see if this Tuesday and this month is going to work with this. And he does not, as a matter of course, like to discuss the details of these meetings. He likes to leave them to, the appropriate staff for this. So this was already going to be an uncomfortable issue. As Ambassador Bolton was trying to move that part of the discussion away, I think he was going to try to deflect it onto another wrap-up topic, Ambassador Sondland leaned in basically to say, Well, we have an agreement that there will be a meeting if specific investigations are put underway. And that's when I saw Ambassador Bolton stiffen. I was sitting behind him in the chair, and I saw him sit back slightly like this. He'd been more moving forward like I am to the table. And for me, that was an unmistakable body language, and it caught my attention. And then he looked up to the clock and, you know, at his watch or towards his wrist in any case. Again, I was sitting behind him and basically he said, well, you know, it's been really great to see you. I'm afraid I've got another meeting.
And did Ambassador Sondland say who his agreement on this White House meeting was with?
In that particular juncture, I don't believe so. It was later, which I'm sure you'll want to talk about, that he did say more specifically.
And what did he say later?
Later, he said that he had an agreement with Chief of Staff Mulvaney that in return for investigations, this meeting would get scheduled.
And was he specific at that point later about the investigations that he was referring to?
He said the investigations in Burisma.
Now, did you have a conversation with Ambassador Bolton after the subsequent meeting with Ambassador Sondland?
I had a discussion with Ambassador Bolton both after the meeting in his office, a very brief one, and then one immediately afterwards, the subsequent meeting.
So the subsequent meeting, or the after both meetings, when you spoke to him and relayed to him what Ambassador Sondland said, what did Ambassador Bolton say to you?
Well, I just want to highlight, first of all, that Ambassador Bolton wanted me to hold back in the room immediately after the meeting. Again, I was sitting on the sofa with a colleague.
Right, everybody but just in that second table. Meeting, what did
yes,
he say?
Yes, but he was making a very strong point that he wanted to know exactly what was being said. And when I came back and related to him, he had some very specific instruction for me. And I'm presuming that that's...
what was that specific instruction?
So a specific instruction was that I had to go to the lawyers, to John Eisenberg, our senior counsel for the National Security Council, to basically say, you tell Eisenberg, Ambassador Bolton told me, that I am not part of this whatever drug deal that Mulvaney and Sondland are cooking up.
What did you understand him to mean by the drug deal that Mulvaney and Sondland were cooking up?
I took it to mean investigations for a meeting.
Did you go speak to the lawyers?
I certainly did.
You relayed everything that you just told us and
I relayed
more.
It precisely, and then the more the details of how the meeting had unfolded as well, which I gave a full description of this in my October 14 deposition.
Mr. Holmes, you have testified that by late August you had a clear impression that the security assistance hold was somehow connected to the investigations that President Trump wanted. How did you conclude that, how did you reach that clear conclusion?
Sir, we've been hearing about the investigation since March, months before, and we've been, President Zelensky had received a letter, a congratulatory letter from the president saying he'd be pleased to meet him following his inauguration in May. We hadn't been able to get that meeting, and then the security hold came up. With no explanation, and I'd be surprised if any of the Ukrainians you said earlier, we discussed earlier, you know, sophisticated people, when they receive no explanation for why that hold was in place, they wouldn't have drawn that conclusion.
Because the investigations were still being pursued?
Correct.
And the hold was still remaining without explanation?
Correct.
So this, to you, was the only logical conclusion that you could reach?
Correct.
Sort of like 2 + 2 = 4?
Exactly.
Chairman, I yield.
That concludes the majority questioning. We are expected to have votes, I think, fairly soon. This would be appropriate time to break, and we'll resume with the minority 45 minutes. If people, before they leave, could allow the witnesses to leave first, and if committee members could come back promptly after votes. recess.